listening through the hymns on pilgrimage, it seems as though we have just as many good hymns to sing for that, and it's remarkable that we've been blessed with such tremendous resources. I'd like tonight, though, to talk about the pilgrimage of a certain individual who has come to mean a great deal to me, and I hope I can share some ideas with you and we can meditate together on the life of this particular individual. In our search to understand what the will of God is for our lives, we have, of course, many resources. We have the Word, we have the resources of the Church itself, we have the whole realm of the creative arts. And I am celebrating in the exposure to the creative arts in a new way at Holden, which I myself personally have never known before. And it has been, you know, a remarkable experience, to say the least, for me. We also have the resource of the lives of other people, either those who have gone on before us or those who share this moment in time with us on this planet. In our searching, we find we can learn and we can be inspired by the lives of others who show forth the power of God. Our faith can be enriched when we see in the concrete deeds of others their response to God. And we ask ourselves, why should it be that certain individuals seem to show forth in such remarkable clarity and in such remarkable power this understanding of the will of God as it should be expressed in this life? And we want to know more about these people. We want to become closer to them because somehow they embody in real life situations that which is important and very meaningful to us. And I think one clue to why some people mean more or somehow stand out or stand out in our memories and in our present thinking is that they present to us in a new and compelling fashion those truths and convictions to which we've given our own assent. These people share with us the visions of God's people, but they have seen these in a seemingly new way or bring fresh insights to help us better understand. And certainly, we need such people. We need such people very much, and God has given us very many of them. Some of them, I think, are in this room tonight. Some of them are known only to each of us or maybe known just to a few of us. But we know that they are there, and what we want to try to do is find out where they are, and once we know them or learn where they are, we want to know how we can use the information that they have to give to us. And tonight, in the sense of the pilgrimage, I'd like to choose one person and lift up for your consideration and meditation. And the title, if we have a little church bulletin here for the meditation, would be To Say Yes to Life. And that person is somebody who is very well known to many of you, the late Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld from Sweden, who was Secretary General from 1953 to the spring or the summer of 1961. Here certainly was a larger-than-life person, one with whom we can identify in many ways, but whose career and whose interests, whose whole being and whose religious faith seemed to be, you know, so much more in excelsis, and I think it's fair to say with Dag Hammarskjöld, in excelsis Deo. And a very helpful topical sentence to sort of lead us into an understanding of what Hammarskjöld meant by saying yes to life would be this sentence. In our era, the road to holiness necessarily passes through the world of action. And both realms here, holiness and the world of action, gripped Dag throughout his life. He kept them apart in his mind when contemplating the eternal issue. But in his life of action as a servant of peace for all people, he intertwined them in a remarkably fresh and creative way, one which I would like to suggest would be worth our consideration this evening. What is so fascinating about his life as an example of faith in this world is that his sense of discipleship, his sense of pilgrimage, of being the selfless servant, was anything but an expression of commitment expressed through our traditional channels of faith. In fact, Hammarskjöld has often been criticized by some of his biographers and students because he chose to express his faith in ways which certainly we would not consider traditional. For instance, he was very careful as Secretary General of being completely neutral in terms of his own personal conduct and behavior, and thus stayed outside of institutional churches that are, you know, if he wanted to worship. Because if he went to a Christian church, then the Hindus might be alienated, and he was there representing all the peoples of the world and didn't want to alienate anybody because of that. And thus, we look outside of traditional sources or places such as the institutional church to understand the kind of faith that Dag Hammarskjöld had brought to bear and which he offers, I think, for us. And I think the way to best understand it is to understand, first of all, that Hammarskjöld didn't come to this powerful religious faith, the sense of pilgrimage, on a very traditional way, but rather he had to overcome fierce, oftentimes huge obstacles, or what I would call barriers to faith. In fact, many times it seems by when you read in his meditations entitled Markings that he had very serious problems. In fact, some of his biographers think that he reflected suicidal tendencies in some of his writings. And this is all the more strange because nobody had more going for him in terms, you know, of the standards of world success than Dag Hammarskjöld. He had perhaps the best possible education, the best possible family, the best possible mind that one could hope for in his life. For instance, from his father, who was a dedicated public servant, he received a very stern and oftentimes crushing sense of commitment to public life, to doing one's best at all times. From his mother and from the neighboring family, it would be nice to have the Archbishop, you know, Nathan Soderblom for a neighbor, next door neighbor, he received the very best in religious training at the time and was exposed to the very best in the writings of the Christian faith. Beyond that, he had a gifted mind of one of great power and analytic ability, and he could have selected any one number of important positions either in the academic world, in the world of business, wherever it might be, and I'm sure could have risen to the very top. He simply had the best education, the best opportunities available in Europe in the 1920s and the 1930s. But he chose the realm of service through nonpartisan civil servanthood. And by the 1940s, it was clear that Hammarskjöld was indeed a very promising and gifted civil servant for his country and for the larger European community. And he gradually moved up the ladder in terms of greater public outreach, becoming involved in some of the European communities. And in the 1950s, it became clear to all the world that here was a man dedicated to the highest ideals of service and public morality. But what no one knew until after his meditations were discovered after his death, that here was also a person who had come to grapple in the most serious and profound ways with the great issues of religious faith. Before he could say yes to life, Hammarskjöld had to tear down some enormously difficult barriers to faith, barriers which we perhaps ourselves face. Very briefly, from Markings, his book, there seem to be four obstacles or barriers which I'd like to briefly outline. First, knowing and trusting in his own ability. He came to know and trust in that ability perhaps too much. He relied excessively on his own resources to cope with the problems of his position. And this became a barrier for him because until he came to faith, he relied very heavily on his personal resources. And when he failed him, as they often did, he blamed himself. And it became, you know, a self-feeding process. A second barrier was that he took inordinate pride. In fact, he was a perfectionist, somebody we would call a workaholic, and doing his job superbly. He drove himself to working 18, 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, sometimes for weeks on end. And he couldn't face the fact for a long time that mortals are not capable of perfection in their public calling. Third, for all his well-known affability and sophistication in dealing daily with persons from every part of the world, he was extremely shy and reserved. This came from his fear, I think, of being hurt by any kind of personal relationship. The barrier he had to overcome was in reaching out for other people, for touching and learning from other people, and taking the risk of doing this and perhaps exposing himself to pain. And usually, rather than exposing himself to potential pain, he would withdraw into himself and simply put on the public self that everybody knew, rather than letting the real inner person himself show forth. And finally, I think, with his analytic powers, which were saturated primarily in the world of trade, business, commerce, and diplomacy, he had great difficulty in living with mysteries, with partial answers, and with incomplete solutions. In religious terms, we could say, he could not live with ambiguity, with doubt, with incompleteness. In short, as one biographer writes, his barriers to faith came from, here's a long quote, an inner aloneness common to all men or women, or certainly to all persons who think freely and deeply about life and care passionately for inner integrity. For many, life is an unending quest for understanding by others, an understanding which is never complete, therefore a quest which is never satisfied, always seeking, always hoping, always expecting an intuitive and total mutuality of feeling, a communion which is never fully realized. And in consequence, these people suffer disillusionment, sometimes despair. And haunted by the impossible demands that he placed on himself, Dag knew despair and anxiety, as everyday companions, even at the height of his public career, didn't know that he was experiencing. He seemed so polished, so fulfilled, his life to be seemed in such control, yet his markings reveal a man really on the edge of despair for a long period of time. The question then, of course, becomes, how could this man come to say yes to life when he had so many doubts, so many barriers in his way? It was not an easy or a simple easily identified process, but this whole overcoming of the barriers was, in the best sense of the word, a conversion. Hammarskjöld himself couldn't identify the hour he first believed. It came to him gradually. On reflection, he looked back in his life, and in a very reflective entry, this for Whit Sunday, 1961, he wrote, "I don't know who or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment, I did answer yes to someone. And from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful, and that therefore my life in self-surrender had a goal. From that moment, I have known what it means not to look back and to take no thought for tomorrow." The important word here is yes, yes to life. It appeared first in his New Year's Reflections, 1953, when he wrote, "To all that shall be, yes." And in markings, his use of that term becomes more triumphant and convincing with each usage. Or put it this way, in searching for faith to tear down his barriers, he committed himself to believing life had ultimate meaning and lived as if that were true. He didn't stop to convince himself of the soundness of an intellectual commitment to faith in God. He trusted that the meaning was there and in the action of the selfless servant for others, the pilgrim, the pilgrimage for peace and brotherhood. From that experience, he came to say yes. From several sources, he found his way over the barriers he had created. He learned from the writings of the great medieval Christian mystics, especially Thomas A. Kempis and Meister Eckhart. He learned from the great expressions of faith found in the music and love of art that he loved so much. And above all, he learned from the biography of Jesus what the demands for total selfish giving were and what the meaning was to the great mysteries in life, revealed by that commitment. Dog, in short, became a disciple. He was able to overcome the doubts and fears that plagued his earlier years. He wrote, and I quote, "As I continued along the way, I learned step by step, word by word, that behind everything in the gospel stands one man and one man's experience. Also behind the prayer that the cup might pass from him and his promise to drink it. Also behind each of the words from the cross." And he wrote what I would like to use as the closing prayer tonight, in July of 1961, something which I simply use and ask all of us to bow our heads in prayer. "Have mercy upon us, have mercy upon our efforts, that we before thee, in love and in faith, righteousness and humility, may follow thee with self-denial, steadfastness, and courage, and meet thee in the silence. Give us a pure heart, that we may see thee, a humble heart, that we may hear thee, a heart of love, that we may serve thee, a heart of faith, that we may live thee." Amen.